Okay, so I've got a few questions here. There's not so many, so this will be a very fast night, maybe. I remember one time Ajahn Brahm just got one question, and he spent the whole hour answering one question. I don't think I'll be able to do that. Anyways. Yeah, a long, long time ago. Huh?
One question for Ajahn is strange.
I think it was one or two. It wasn't very many. It was the first night. Usually the first night's very quiet. People are a little bit shy, you know. And then after the second or third, you get a whole bunch of questions. So by the fourth and fifth night, he's just flying through it, just like giving one sentence answers. Well, anyways, let's see what's here. Like a lucky dip. Oh, that's a bit too long. Okay. Well, maybe this one later. There's not so many, actually. This one is about ringing the bell in the morning. So if I'm here, yes, I'll ring the bell after the morning meditation to let you know that breakfast is ready. That's not a very hard question. That's very important. Yes, breakfast is very important. We need to eat. Okay, why do monks chant? What is the spiritual meaning of in chanting? So there's many reasons why monks chant. I was living in a monastery that did a lot of chanting, and you know, chanting was a part of the practice. And one of the reasons why they chant is because it just allows people to, you know, reflect upon the Buddha's teachings. A lot of the chanting is done in Pali, but in this monastery there would be I think like classes on the meaning behind the chants. So you know, during like the period of the rains retreat, where the monks focus on their meditation and on their chanting, they would teach you know, the young monks and the people staying in the monastery the meanings of the chant. So as a practice, what they would do is they would get together, you know, in the morning and in the afternoon and in the evening, and they would get together and they'll do some chanting just before the meditation. Usually it's chanting before the meditation. And then you sort of ask them, you know, what kind of meaning or what kind of practice and how beneficial is it? And a lot of people say that chanting is, you know, it's something that you can... It's quite, you can, you know, you're chanting it, you're using your voice. It sort of brings a certain energy and a focus to the mind. So they say that it gives them like a sort of boost before they would sit and meditate. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, people chant. And sometimes we chant as a way to give a blessing to people. So I like to see it as, you know, when you go to the opera or something like that, and you're listening to music, and that music has some sort of effect on you. And I think in the same way, if you get monks chanting for you, they're sort of giving, you know, a little bit of their wisdom, a little bit of their loving kindness, and they're doing it through chanting. And a lot of times, you know, especially in our monastery, we chant for people who come and feed the monks every day. There's a short chant, the one that I was doing today, just the end part. I'm really bad with the meanings of chants, but I think it's basically the merit that you made by giving the food to the monks, and may you share that merit to you know, to people that you know who have passed away, so that they can take that merit, and that merit can help them move on to their next life. And also chanting is used like in funeral ceremonies. We like to chant the Metta Sutta, which is the Sutta on loving kindness, just spreading that to the people who are suffering and also to the person who's passed away. You know, Ajahn Brahm would like to say it's sort of like, you know, when they die, they're sort of like in economy class. And after you do the chanting, they may jump to business But if it's Ajahn Brahm chanting, they'll jump to first class. Something like that. So chanting is helpful, yeah, but it's not everything, the everything of Buddhism. You may, because sometimes, you know, if you go to certain countries, it may seem that the main focus, you know, of the practice is the chanting. But it's not so much with the way the monks practice in Bodhinyana Monastery. We do very little chanting and we spend more time, you know, cultivating the mind in seclusion and in meditation. Any questions? There's not many questions in this box, so please ask questions. No. Yes? Yeah, that's what I was saying. Is you know, like if you get a monk, I remember you get a monk and he's got like deep meditation, very good wisdom, and then when he chants like with his whole heart, you can actually feel something special there. And yeah. Okay. Okay, thank you for the retreat. It's been great. My question is, how can we incorporate the contemplation of the four immeasurables into our meditation practice? What are the four immeasurables? Can anybody was it trigger my memory? Who asked the question? Four immeasurables, what are they again?
Maybe I've heard wrong, but like loving kindness.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, these are very nice, fluffy emotions that you can... fluffy, lovely emotions that you can develop in your meditation practice. It's, you could say the emotional side to the practice, because sometimes when we're just watching the breath or just being silent, it can be quite dry, quite boring. And I like to think about it as these are the little toys that the Buddha has given us to play around with. Like, you know, monks in the monastery, we like our toys. If you go to the workshop, there's hammer drills, there's chisels, there's drop saws, there's, you know, any toy you can imagine for the monks to play with when they're doing work for the monastery. So in the same way, yeah, so the monks don't get bored. You know, imagine a life in a monastery without power tools. That'd be so boring. So, and in the way, you know, the Buddha gave all these skillful means, all these little things for us to play with, and you know, these four immeasurables like metta, medito, and what's the other one? Oh yeah, karuna, which is compassion, and upeka, which is equanimity. So you know, metta, we've just chanted that, and it's just this kindness, this love that we have towards one another. You know, it's if you can develop it, it's actually a wonderful thing, actually, to have this good friendship with people, a connection, and it feels good. And it's, you know, it brings happiness to the mind, and that's the reason why we do it, to do it for happiness. And then you have compassion, which is basically when you see somebody who is suffering, who is going through a tough time, and instead of finding, sometimes when people are going through a tough time, we sort of like to find fault with them. We like to sort of pick on them. Oh, look at that guy, he's having a hard time. And, you know, we feel good about ourselves because we're making, like, an accurate judgment of somebody. But instead, compassion is flipping that around and just looking at people and seeing them if they're going through a hard time. You can say, okay, this person's going through a hard time. How can I be, you know, how can I be kind towards him? You can see that the person's suffering and you know that they're not having a good time. So what can you do to make their lives a little bit better? So that's what, you know, compassion is about, is to see and to know and to act when the time is ready. And mudita is sympathetic joy. It's basically, you know, rejoicing in other people's good fortune. And the opposite of that is, you know, people have jealousy towards other people's possessions. I think this one monk, he said that when he was a lay person, he saw a guy driving a Ferrari and he was jealous because he had a really nice car. But then he goes, oh, but I decided to practice mudita. So instead of having jealousy and envy, he was joyful that that person was able to make enough money to drive a beautiful car. So you can see, you know, you can see where these, and you have equanimity as well, which is basically just being able to just observe life and not interfere, really. You know, just observe life and just be quiet and just allow life to just flow on. And in a sense, if you can do that, that brings like a great sense of peace and ease to one's life. And in fact, one of the monks from the Wat Pa Pong tradition, one of Ajahn Chah's disciples, Ajahn Chah actually picked him out because he was a well-practiced monk, and his name is Ajahn Liam, and he is well known for his equanimity. And one of the stories that Ajahn Brahm likes to tell is when they were having the cremation for Ajahn Chah, I think they were, it's amazing how famous he was. I remember somebody telling me his cremation went for 1 week, and throughout that week, over 1 million people from Thailand and around the world came to visit him. He had that much of an impact on people's lives. So yeah, it's amazing that one person can be so wise, and just a simple guy living northeast Thailand. His family's a farmers, but he was able to, you know, give up the world and become a monk. And because of that, he practiced really well and became really wise, and he was able to, you know, connect with people, all sorts of people, you know, Westerners, Asians, military, educated, and all that kind of stuff. He had the ability to just know what to say at the right time. So because of that, he became very famous. And in fact, you know, one of, you know, in Thailand, they like to talk about psychic powers. And another famous monk is Ajahn Mahabua. And, you know, they were talking about what type of psychic power Ajahn Chah had. Did he have the divine ear? You know, the divine ear is like, you have this power where you can hear things from far away. And there was actually a monk who could do that. And Ajahn Brahm was telling that story. There was this monk, he was able to hear the conversations in the village down the road. And it was due to like having deep meditation and the mind opening up and being powerful, you can do things like that. And apparently this monk got so cocky, he thought he was the man. So he was like sitting in Ajahn Chah's seat. You know, he's like, this is like the big boss's seat. And he was only like a junior monk, and he was sitting on his seat. And that really upset everybody. And the word got around, Ajahn Chah found out about it, and Ajahn Chah took him aside and I think gave him a bollocking. He told him off. And I think from that day onwards, that monk left and he never came back. But you know, there's stories about things like this happening in Thailand. But anyways, Ajahn Mahabua said Ajahn Chah didn't really have any of those fancy psychic powers. He probably did read your mind. But, you know, he didn't have the divine ear or anything. Oh, he probably had that as well. But the one thing that was very impressive was that Ajahn Mahabua said Ajahn Chah had the psychic power, this is a psychic power, of teaching the Dhamma, of connecting with people, teaching them, showing them the way. And that was his special psychic power. That's why he became very famous and very, you know, likable by many people. And anyways, Ajahn Liam, he's known for his equanimity. When they were burning Ajahn Chah's body, a year after he died, they built a stupa. Ajahn Liam would have built it. He's known for his building skills. He's so good that he doesn't need to write anything down. He just does it all in his head. And he's been building for, you know, many, many years. And I met him last year, and he was still building. So anyways, they would burn this cremation site, and it was like shaped into a stupa. And then for some reason, the burning didn't go right. The actual whole stupa started to catch on fire instead of just that little pile of Ajahn Chah. The whole thing just lit up. And in the manner of Ajahn Liam, being the monk, he doesn't worry about anything. He just looked at it. I don't know for how long, but he was probably equanimous. He just turned around and walked off. I think he said to his monks, "I'm tired, I'm going to sleep." So that's like, you know, the, you know, equanimity, you know, medito, having joy in other people's success. And, you know, there's people in this world that you can be joyous over. You know, a lot of the monks in our monastery, they have a lot of medito towards Ajahn Brahm for the work that he's done. You know, spreading Buddhism, helping out the nuns, helping out Newbury, doing the best he can to you know, inspire people, to help people out. And if just thinking about that brings up a sense of medito and this good feeling in your heart, an emotion really, like this fuzzy, fluffy emotions. That's why we have all these teddy bears here. Aren't they so cute? Aren't they so lovely? Don't you want to pick them up and hug them? So, honestly, emotion does have an important part to this meditation practice. Yeah, but some of us are more cerebral people, so we're more like analytical. We're trying to work things out. We're trying to sort out our minds, and that's fine. Some people more lean towards that way, and some people are more, you know, emotional type of practitioners. They follow their heart with the way they practice, and some people are like in between. They got a bit of both. So, you know, just, you know, these teachings, whatever you read is there to help you to overcome whatever problems you may have in your meditation practice. So if you're, you know, you're struggling, you're having a hard time, practice a bit of metta. Or just remember how metta makes you feel, and just try to bring that back up in your meditation practice. And also, you know, medito, just rejoicing in other people's goodness, having gratitude, and thinking about that, and see what kind of feeling that brings up, and use that in your meditation. And what's the other one? Compassion. Yes, compassion. In compassion, you know, just feeling for somebody who's going through a hard time, and just spreading them a bit of metta, a bit of care. And knowing that all you need to do is just give them a bit of time and they'll overcome their problems. Okay.
Is it possible to think of someone when you're meditating?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the beginning it's good to play around and trying to work with your mind, and if thinking about somebody does help you calm down, then it's good. Yes, you can also send loving kindness. Yeah, somebody that you're close to, it's very easy to bring up that feeling towards that person. Yeah, why not? You know, you got to try things out. And I think that eventually, you know, when you practice for a long time, things start to become more simpler. You have a few tools that you'd like to use, and that's all you really, really need. Yeah. I think at the beginning when you start practicing, you like to keep things simple, and then you come to a few retreats, you get this technique, you get that technique, and then meditation becomes really complicated. And it's like, oh no, this is so overwhelming. It's more troubling than anything else. So then you simplify things. And then you just use one or two techniques and just go on with that. So it's good to play around, to keep yourself interested, not to get bored, you know, with the practice. Yeah. No? More questions? Yes? No? Maybe? Come on.
Am I allowed to? Okay, I'm going. With the loving kindness and the compassion and all of the human beautiful.
Yes.
I'm thinking and feeling that unless we actually have that within us for ourselves, it's almost impossible to really give it totally authentically.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have to learn how to love yourself, I guess, or develop yourself first before you can help other people. It's like the Buddha said, how can you pull somebody out of the mud if you're in the mud with them? So yeah. So you have to get out of the mud first before you start helping people. So yeah, I have to get out of the mud. Okay. Okay. Question. Doubt. How can one overcome the feeling of doubt in regards to the Buddha's path? Two. There's like four questions here. Okay, we'll start off with that one. Doubt. I sort of answered that this morning on the topic of the five hindrances, but maybe the person was too tired or something like that. They didn't hear it. So basically doubt is this questioning, you know, questioning whether this path of practice really works. And usually doubt manifests itself as things that you don't understand. So you go up to the teacher and say to the teacher, Ajahn, what does it mean to get peaceful? Ajahn, what's the meaning of, you know, non-self? Ajahn. And then the Ajahn would say something, oh, this is what it means, blah, blah, blah. So in a sense, the way you overcome doubt in this practice is to ask questions. So it looks like a lot of people here don't have doubt because there's not a lot of questions. And also, like I said this morning, is once you start having confidence in yourself and in your own practice, knowing somehow, some way, that you're moving in the right direction because you have, you know, that sense of becoming more peaceful, becoming more still, you know, living a life where you're letting go of more, you're understanding suffering, you're understanding more about anicca, the impermanence of life, you're understanding, you know, the non-self concept of, you know, things have been conditioned, you don't make things personal, and you start living a life which is basically free of worry and stress. You can wake up in the morning and say to yourself, I feel good. Or life is good. You know, how many of us can really do that? How many of us can wake up in the morning and say, yes, life is good? Not many of us. So it's something for us to work towards, you know. I think through experience, you know, you don't have to become enlightened to overcome doubt. You can overcome a lot of your doubts by just, you know, attaining a bit of peace, letting go a little bit more, and that sort of gives you the understanding that this Buddhist path actually works. And in a sense, you start to develop faith in the practice, and that also helps you overcome doubt, is the amount of faith that you have in the Buddhist teachings. So yeah. Okay, next question. Buddhism does not believe in the notion of God. So Buddhism does not believe in a notion of God. What does a Buddhist believe in? Okay, Buddhists, we don't believe in a notion of God in a sense where the Buddha was this mightily all-great being that created the world, that controls our destiny. We don't believe in such things. But as a Buddhist, we believe in karma. The right view, basically, is what a Buddhist believes in. And right view is a part of the Eightfold Path. And it basically means having the view that there is such thing as the law of karma and also the law of rebirth, being born again. We don't live once, we live many times. Isn't that scary? So a lot of times when people come into the monastery, they say to me, oh, I'm making some good karma today because I want a better life in my next life. And I tell them, oh, that's silly. You don't want a better life in your next life. You want a better life now. So I think when you want to make good karma, you make it for this moment. You make it for this life right now. And yes, the idea of rebirth can be quite challenging for some people. Some people may not believe it at all. And in a sense, as Buddhist practitioners, we don't really know ourselves. Because we only can remember this life. We can't remember our past lives. And so yes, there is a sense of doubt that the mind, you know, that you know, this body and mind, does it really get reborn? That's a big question. But there are ways to be able to actually find out, and the way that's been taught here is to meditate. Yes, you have to meditate. You have to meditate if you want to find out about things. You know, you can always ask the teacher, but if you really want to find the answers, you can meditate. And all the answers are found in the meditation. And basically what happens is that you meditate to the point where your mind is so still, is so strong and so powerful that it becomes like a well-behaved mind. You can ask the mind to do things for you. So basically the mind is so powerful you can ask itself to just remember a past life. And then the mind will go into the past life and remember something about it. But if you don't have the deep meditations, then it's basically down to your, you know, the faith that you have, or maybe the reasoning as well. There's been studies about it. There's actually books in the library in the monastery about this professor that has been doing research to just document kids who remember their past lives. So what he does, I flick through a book and it's quite interesting actually. What he does is he'll hear like a rumor or something like that in a village in India about a kid who can remember his past life, and he would go there, you know, with his pen and his paper, and he'll write everything down with his glasses on because he's a professor. And then you'll write everything down, and then the interesting thing is that these kids will have like birthmarks, like maybe like a scar, like on the neck. And that birthmark would be like, it would correspond to the way that person died in the previous life. So the kid or whoever remembered the life, he says, oh yeah, I remember a life, I lived in such and such a village, you know, I lived until this age, and the reason why I died is because I got, you know, shot in the back of the head. And then the professor did his research, he went back to the village and got all the information, and he actually got enough evidence to compile a study to sort of, what is it, to yeah, to compare or to just bring to light that that reincarnation or rebirth is an actual fact, because there's enough evidence there to prove it. So, I mean, I don't know, I didn't read all the books, but there were a few books in the library, so he has done a lot of study on it. So, you know, if you're interested in something like that, you can read about it. And also, it's like when I was a younger monk, I was interested in like out-of-body experiences. And, you know, when I think about out-of-body experiences, the ability for the mind to be separated from the body. And that sort of like indicates that, you know, if the mind can be separated from this body, it can go find another body and start life again. And yeah, it's kind of interesting, like these near-death experiences. There's this one that always stuck to my mind when, you know, these guys, you know, lived, obviously, to tell the tale. And basically he was in a car, driving down the highway in the middle of the night in his big truck, I think. And then there was another car coming in the same direction, and they had like a head-on collision. Like you can see the cars coming, like boop, 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 boop. And then it gets closer. And then before the actual impact, this guy who survived it saw himself come out of his body. For some, huh? Yeah, man, that's pretty cool, eh? For some reason, that fear or that just knowing that something bad is going to happen separated the mind from the body. But, you know, obviously he came back to his body. So they would have rushed him to hospital and resuscitated and brought him back to life. But he was, he survived to tell the tale. And that sort of makes us question whether, you know, this mind and body is just only for one life. If the mind can separate from the body, that means a lot of things can happen. You know, a lot of things can happen. And actually, I was talking to a gentleman today, and he had an out-of-body experience. And he came back to his body, and he told people about the conversations and what he saw, and they were, like, astounded. You know, how did you know that? It was because he was out of his body, somewhere else. And, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, and also, yeah, that's rebirth, and you got, like, karma. You know, very basic. I was just reading something this morning, and it's from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's very nice. And the Buddha said that, you know, even monastics should make good karma. You know, making good karma, you know, teaching people meditation, helping out in the monastery. And the Buddha said, you know, as a monk in his previous life, I think, or something like that, he made a lot of good karma, and that was the cause of happiness. And he said he lived like many eons imbued in, you know, loving kindness and in all these fuzzy, lovely emotions. And he went to this realm and he was so happy, and he went to that realm and he was really happy. And it's all because of making merit, making good karma. And, you know, that's also a part of right view. And that's what Buddhists believe in. And it is a great thing, you know, living in a monastery. You can see, like, you can see the people living there, the ones that make the good karma, the selfless ones, they're the happy ones. You know, they're the ones that you know that is going to practice well, because they're giving, they're creating those good emotions, they're freeing their minds. And in fact, a lot of the, you know, if you read the gradual training about the Buddha's teachings, it always starts with being a virtuous person. And from that virtue, you know, from that goodness comes like a sense of no remorse. So, you know, you know you've been a good person, so you're not guilty for the things you've said. You know, you're not stealing from people, you don't feel that. You don't feel that, you know, that guilt. Or you're not hurting anybody. Or you're not saying bad things. Because when you do those things, they sort of have a negative weight on your mind. So instead, you you know, you be a virtuous person, and that leads to non-remorse, no remorse, which means a mind that is, you know, free in a sense. You know, it's free, it's light. You know, light. You know, light is like even-mindedness, you know, a coolness of mind. And from there, you know, the meditation starts to take off. It's just, it's not just like meditation for meditation's sake. It's a complete path. You know, the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, not just one path, the path of meditation. So in a sense, we're here, we're practicing for 2 days, right livelihood. We're pretending to be monks. We're pretending to be nuns. I can get you a razor so you can shave your heads. Yeah? You can even take it further. I'll give you a shaver so you can take off your eyebrows. That's full renunciation. Can you do it? Your hair will grow back. Your hair will grow back. Yeah, we're the shaver eyebrows. Yeah.
Why?
I was a part of the tradition. Basically, in the past, what happened was when there was Thailand and Cambodia, there were conflict wars, you know, wars happening. I don't know the exact details, but Cambodia was sending spies as monks into Thailand to get intel so they can bring it back and, you know, go to war, basically. So so what they did, the government did, was to distinguish between spies and real monks, they got the monks in Thailand to shave off their eyebrows.
Oh.
Yeah. And that, you know, that tradition, you could say, stuck until now. So that's why we've got to shave off our eyebrows.
So you have to shave them off.
We've got to shave them off. And it's also good in a sense because it's sort of, you know, monks are attached to their eyebrows. We've got to be attached to something, right? So we attach to our eyebrows. So it's a great way of letting go. Really, it's true. You go, it's like, why do you have your eyebrows for? You got to shave them off. But they don't shave them off, they leave them on. That's attachment.
So, can I ask, and this is a silly question.
Yeah. Yes.
He's in training.
He's a novice, yeah. We're all in training, yeah. He's in training.
But he's not here all the time, so how does that work?
Oh, he's, because I'm a very easygoing monk. I'm like, if you want to come, you can come. If you want to stay in your room and meditate, you can stay in your room and meditate. Yeah. So he doesn't have to come.
He's just skiving off.
He's my upatak, he's my attendant. He washes my bowl. He opens the door for me. He's a very nice monk. They do it for the first 5 years, actually. It's always, the tradition is always, you're always looking after the senior monk. So if I were to go out with Ajahn Brahm, I'll look after Ajahn Brahm, even though I'm a senior monk. Or I'll look after Ajahn Api or Ajahn Bamali. It's, you know, a sense of respect for the people who have ordained before you. And it's actually a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
Just to be kind, to carry their yam or make them a cup of coffee or, you know, fix their robes, stuff like that.
It's being of service.
Yeah, being a service, you
and,
know.
So when you're in training, you don't look at anyone ever.
What do you mean?
No, he's always got his eyes down, so he's never looking at
him. Oh, no. That's what he likes to do. I didn't tell him to do that.
It's just choice.
Yeah, it's just choice. Okay. When I was sitting there as a young monk, I was like, So it's really up to you. Anyways, what was I talking about? Anyway, I'll go on to the next question. That's enough information. So, yeah. No fuss. Why be fussy for? It just creates a lot of suffering. Okay. Can meditation be able to offer answers to a Buddhist with many questions? Oh, it's the same one about doubt. If not, how can one get answers to their questions? There's a famous monk. And he's on the internet. And he's called Ajahn YouTube. He has all the answers for you. Just go on YouTube and go, I have this problem. Click. And the answer will come. I don't know how to answer this question. Anyway, okay, can meditation be able to offer answers to Buddhists with many questions? Oh, too many questions. Don't worry about questions. But anyways, meditation can actually. It's, you know, it's like the Asian people like to say, if you meditate deeply enough, this is my mom likes to say this, you know, my mom, she's a Buddhist, but she's not Theravadan, but she's Mahayana, and, you know, I think a lot of, like, the Asians are, you know, they have this, like, what's the word, like, suspicion about things. And she said, you know, she said, oh, if you meditate deeply enough, you'll know everything, like, everything, you know. You know how to read people's minds, you know the weather, you know what's happening in America, you know everything in that sense. But there is some truth to it, I think. If you meditate deeply enough, then there will be no questions. Because you're content. You know, you're content. When there's contentment, a sense of peace, then why would there be questions? The only reason why you ask questions is because you're not peaceful, you're not content. So in a way, meditation doesn't answer your questions, but it just gets rid of your questions. Yeah, so no more questions arises in the mind. That's a very nice thing. It gets to a point where you don't really need to ask too many questions. Because you're like content with your practice. Yeah.
The answers to questions you haven't asked. Huh? The answers to questions you haven't
yes.
asked.
Is it wise to attach to a spiritual teacher who can guide the students like a guru? I guess so. Yeah, there's a saying that putting your faith into a teacher is like betting on the horses. You don't know which one's going to win. But if you do your research, you can put a good bet on. So in a sense you don't really know whether the person's really enlightened or not, but you can have like some sort of feeling. Or like I said before, the Buddha's advice to people on judging whether a person is enlightened or not. So you know, by reputation, by living with them, by attending their retreats, you get a feeling and you get to know whether this person is enlightened or not, or well-practiced or not. And I think getting attached, I mean, attachment can mean so many things. You can get attached to a teacher where you become like, I don't know, like too attached. Or you can be attached to a teacher where, you know, you trust him and you trust him and you can, you know, you listen to what he says. And I think if you have that sort of, you know, faith in a teacher, if he tells you what to do, like he tells you to, you know, contemplate this sutta or do this kind of practice, and if he can see, you know, your temperament and know, and he knows what is good for you, then having that, you know, that trust would make you give more of a, you know, more of a fuller effort, you know, into the practice, I think. Because you have so much faith and trust in a person, and if that person tells you to jump, you say, how high? That kind of thing. So in a sense, you know, it's good to have a spiritual teacher if you can find a good one. But a lot of times there's some people there that can be quite dodgy, and you have to watch out for them, because sometimes they can just lead you down the wrong path. You know, there's been stories about that, about monks who, you know, are not very, monks who are not keeping the precepts. They can be quite charismatic and they have a large following, but after some time people start to see, you know, their flaws. and see the dodginess that they're going through. And you hear stories about this in places around the world. It's kind of scary, actually, some of the stories that you hear. And it sort of puts people off religion. You know, it gives a bad name to Buddhism. And it does happen. It's kind of sad to see, but that's the world that we live in. But I think, yeah, if you, you know, like myself, I have faith in, you know, Ajahn Brahm, and I listen to his teachings, and I think they work. And it has helped me over the years. So, yeah, why not? Just try it. Find a good teacher. That's what I say. Yeah, you have to find a good teacher. And it's also karma as well. Sometimes we just meet certain people, and we have a connection, and maybe it's because of past lives or something like that. I was actually very fortunate to ordain at a very young age. Okay, any more questions? Any questions?
No, I don't
know. Oh, it's almost 9 o'clock. I can't believe that. Yes, Steve.
Is there such a thing as a bad teacher? That's
what I'm Yes, I had bad teachers when I was growing up in high school because I got bad grades. I failed miserably because the teachers couldn't teach me right. They're all bad teachers. Yeah, sometimes people...
Say you're stuck in your meditation. So
yep.
Something to understand is the path doesn't necessarily go smoothly.
Yes.
And sometimes we need help from other people to kind of recorrect.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, our lives are like this, like waves. Sometimes we just need somebody to just talk to us, you know, or sometimes we need somebody to talk to. Just let off some steam. Yeah, you know, monks are like everyday people. Sometimes we have to let off steam. And it's always good to, you know, the teacher gives you like reassurance. You may ask him a question and then he'll give you an answer. But it's not that really, it's more like getting the attention from the teacher. The teacher giving you like his metta. His kindness, that makes you feel good. That makes you feel good, so that overcomes, or that makes you forget about the problems you've had, you know, in your meditation practice.
Is that a craving?
What is?
The wanting of the metta from the teacher?
Yeah, you know, everybody wants a bit of attention from the teacher. There's a bit of craving there. But I don't think it's harmful because it makes you feel good. And it gives the teacher the opportunity to be a teacher, to be compassionate, to be kind towards, you know, the people he ordained. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Because, you know, the main reason why we ordain in the monastery is for Ajahn Brahm, really. That's why we go there. That's why we give up our lives. You know, everything we have, cars. I had a pretty crappy car, but still a car. Jobs, everything, just for this teacher. Yes. Huh? I think not because entirely, but it's one of the main reasons, I think, for a lot of people who ordain in the monastery. Yeah, because it's the teacher that inspires the monks. It's the teacher that's done the practice, who is actually a living example that the path can be attainable. And it's lovely to see that somebody with two legs, two arms, two eyes, ears, and a big tummy, like Ajahn Brahm, can get all that, get in, you know, practice well. So why can't we do it? You know, why can't we do it? That's what I like about this this path. It's a path for everybody. You don't have to be a super intellect. You don't have to be a god. You don't have to be handsome. You don't have to be beautiful. You can just be anybody. You know, you just need to be able to listen to the teachings and put it into practice. And just have a belief in yourself. You know, if somebody else can do it, so can you. And always looked at it in that way. You know, if somebody can do it, so can you. Because sometimes you think, oh, Ajahn Brahm is special. He was born in, you know, full lotus position and he was in jhana. Oh my gosh. It's sort of like saying that, oh, he can do it, but I can't do it. It's sort of like, you know, you're stopping yourself from you know, attaining what's attainable in this life. And the Buddha said, you know, every one of us can become enlightened. Every one of us can see the truth. You just got to be able to give up everything. Shave your hair. Shave your long hair or your short hair. Take off your eyebrows. Donate it to, you know, Cancer Foundation. Make wigs out of it. You're doing something good. And then ordain. Why not? No, it's not for everybody. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't be teasing you guys. Anyways.
That's a very long queue at the monastery.
Oh, yes, there's a very long queue. This is like it's just packed to the rafters. There's no room left. The waiting list is, how long's the waiting list? You're on the waiting list, right? Are you on the waiting list? You are, right? Yeah, I heard. How long is it?
3 years for overseas.
3 years.
What's the other
waiting list? 3 years for overseas people. Whoa, that's a long time. It must be a really good monastery. It's like going to, you know, a really good restaurant. You have to book like 2-3 years in advance. three Michelin star restaurant. But this is like a 5 Michelin star monastery.
what's the waiting list for?
For people wanting to become monks.
Oh, yeah.
There is a waiting list.
The Catholic Church could take a note on that.
Well, we're trying to expand. Ajahn Bamali's been working really hard trying to get approval from the council so he could expand. You know, this property is quite large. It extends all the way down in that direction for a long way. And a part of the plan is to build more kutis there, more huts, so monks could move in and, you know, enjoy life in the bush. But it's taken a long time. It's been in the works for, I think, 4 or 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, they decided to do it 5 years ago, and they were serious about it, I think, 3 years ago. They've been putting the plans through council and all that kind of stuff, but it's not working. So, yeah, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen.
The waiting list is so long because the monks in the monastery are not graduating.
Well, you don't want me to stay there anymore. Do you want me to leave?
I'm just thinking, right, you have to make space for others. So.
Yeah, I'd take up quite a bit of space, don't I?
Actually, I asked the question, how did I get to graduate?
Like, see what you do?
To graduate?
No, she's just saying, like, when a monk graduates, is like, he's wise enough, he's old enough, so just basically kick him out the monastery so he can go somewhere else because he's graduated. You know, when you graduate, you leave and make room for the little babies that are going to ordain. Little babies like Prashad, he wants to ordain. No, they're from all over the joint. There's one monk there, he's from Korea, yeah. But it's kind of funny, actually. It's like we're walking around a pindabat table, and Koreans are vegetarian, the monks are, and he's like picking up chicken. He's picking up fish, and I say, are you meant to do that? And he says, no, but don't tell my teacher. Yes. So yeah, there's only one Korean monk in the monastery. You know who he is if you ever go there. But don't tell him that I told you that. Otherwise, I'm going to get in trouble. You know how strict the Koreans are. Okay. There's one last question. It's basically about, please explain the way to take practice into our day-to-day busy lives. So what I'll do is I'll answer that question on the last day, because there's a final talk. So basically that's the idea, is to incorporate what you've learned here today. Take it out into the world, become better people, come back here again, recharge, and do the same thing. And hopefully, yeah, you'll create good karma for yourself. For yourself, for this life, and for future lives as well. Okay, that's it. No more questions. Any more questions? Final question. That's a deep question.
But if you don't understand what consciousness is, how do you identify in your meditation?
It's easy.
When we observe the breath, there will be something observing the breath.
Just who's observing the breath? The one who knows, yeah. As Ajahn Chah would say that. It's just, you know, the knower, you know, the one who knows. Just, you know, who's listening right now? Is it Pauline, or is it just the ear and the mind, which is listening? Beginner's class, yeah. Okay. Beginners, right? There's a lot of beginners here. Yeah.
So when you say set your mind to present moment, mm-hmm. awareness, right, and watching the breath, when you're watching that, actually, who is watching? What's going on? Because if you watch too hard, you become tired.
You do become tired.
So who is actually watching?
Who's watching it is like presence of mind. There's something that is... You know, when you're awake, you know, you're listening to what I say, you know, whatever's listening, that, you know, that is watching it. You don't have to put too many labels on it. It's not Pauline, it's not Malaysian, it's not young, it's not old. It's, something's happening here right now. You can hear me, right?
Deaf.
Are you deaf? Can you hear me? It's just putting it into like a different way or different terms. It's, you know, whatever's listening, whatever's hearing, whatever's knowing. That is what is happening. That is what is watching the breath. Really, if you look carefully, it's not Pauline that's watching the breath. It's not Auntie Burr. You know, it's just a process happening. Yeah, that's what it is. It's not complicated. It is what it is, really. Yeah.
Well, it's good to clarify.
Yeah. And it's just watching the breath. Watch it go in, go out. You know, for beginners, there's always the thinking mind that's the trouble. Because sometimes we don't have enough. The mind is just so cluttered, and there's nothing that we can really do. It's just sitting there, one thought after another thought. It's like the monkey mind. Mm-hmm. What happens if you have the monkey mind, and if you can't shut it up? Huh? You end up going bananas. So yeah, people should just give themselves a chance and just see where
it
takes you.
Story?
I don't know the story actually. I don't know the story. Yeah, that's an Ajahn Brahm story.
Just wondering. The thoughts are running in the mind.
Yeah.
Do they represent the person, the individual?
In a sense, it does. Because when you meditate and when your mind becomes quiet, you can understand that there's nothing there. There's nobody. It's just empty. And when you start thinking, you know, how do you think? in terms of, oh, you know, what I'm going to do the next day, or you're thinking of my family, or, you know, my future, or thinking about something which is important in your life. So you can sort of sense that the thinking mind is what the sense of self is. Yeah. And then, you know, when your mind becomes quiet, you can start to see, oh, the sense of self is like disappearing. It's not really there anymore.
So it's not an illusion.
Illusion. What is not an illusion?
The thoughts
are... No, I think they're real. Yeah, because they make you do stuff. You know, you have a thought about, you know, going to the toilet. So you have to get up and go to the toilet. Or you have thoughts about, you know, looking after your family back home. You get up, you actually do something about it. So in a sense, the thoughts are real. Yeah, they are real. No, I don't really have negative thoughts in my mind. No.
They never come up.
They do come up from time to time. Sometimes you just rub up against people in the monastery. Some people just irritate you. Yeah, really irritate you, but... But most of the time, you know, I don't really have too many negative thoughts in the monastery. It's, you know, because you learn how to live skillfully in the community that you're living with. Yeah, you learn how to interact with the monks according to, like, you know, the Dhamma, the Buddhist teachings, and in a way that sort of frees up a lot of negativity in the mind. But still, because you're not enlightened, there's always negativity will arise in the future or in the present. You're not free from it yet.
Yeah,
and it's yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's helping you. Yeah, it was, because you can see the harm that it's causing you. It's like I like to say, the mind knows how to protect itself, or the mind, you know, intuitively wants to have happiness. The mind intuitively, you know, knows how to protect itself. So if it does experience too much negativity, it will just block it out. It should block it out, because it doesn't want to be unhappy. It wants to be happy. Oh, yeah, that's really hard, eh? Checkmate.
Huh?
Cage. Cage fight. Just try your best, be patient.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard. Sometimes work is hard.
Because energetically, though, I mean, like, it is having some effect. Like, if he's in a situation where, you know, like, there's just this negative ongoing, like, there's, it's almost sort of like quite, I mean, unless he's got a skill to put a shield around his field, but it's going to seep in on some level.
Yeah, I think if you can't deal with it, there's skillful means that you can apply, but I always remember, because sometimes being a Buddhist, you think that you have to get along with everybody. You have to be friends with everybody.
In the monastery house?
Huh?
In your monkville?
It happens, yeah. Yeah, because we're not enlightened. We have our defilements. We have our angers, our, you know, controls, our jealousies, you know, that's all in the monastery.
Yeah.
And I remember the Buddha saying that, you know, you try to avoid situations or people that bring you down. So when I read that, I thought, oh yeah, that's good advice, because sometimes you think you have to be friendly and get on with everybody, but you don't. There's certain people that, you know, you stay away from.
And that's what the Buddha advised. Sometimes with your work, if you're in a place where it's horrible, just leave or something. Leave, right? Yeah, but yeah, I know it's a toxic environment. But you hear about, you know, Google is a very successful company because they have a moral standard. People treat each other right. People treat each other nicely. So there are, you know, jobs out there where you can find where you know, people keep a standard because, you know, emotional well-being is important to their workers because that's how you get the best production from people. Anyways, it's getting late. I think I should stop. You? Yeah. Yes.
Very good.
Sado, sado, sado. Sado, sado. I can't do the Ajahn Brahm sado. Sorry. Sado. Oh, no. It's a bit too much. Okay, finito. You can meditate if you want. You go to bed if you want. It's really up to you. I've had a busy day, so I'm going to retire.